listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. As we welcome the brilliant and brave Anita Hill to the library tonight, I think of several other extraordinary public figures who have graced this stage, making it, as Cornel West once pointed out to me, sanctified space. The great historian John Franklin Hope, the playwright August Wilson, the journalist Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote about the great African-American migration, and they are all mentioned in Anita Hill's graceful memoir and call to action titled Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding a Home in America. And I think of Liberian activist Lema Bowie, a recent Nobel Peace Prize winner who was here just a few weeks ago, another woman who raised her voice on behalf of social and economic justice. Anyone who was living in 1991, and I presume many of us in this room were, can tell you where they were when they heard Anita Hill testify in the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Those hearings catalyzed the nation's conversation about the issue of sexual harassment, and Anita Hill points out in her beautiful new book that talking publicly changed our collective understanding of the nature of a behavior that had been the bane of women's and girls' workplace experience for centuries. Now, with the national foreclosure crisis affecting the nation's economy and morale, she reminds us that this can be another impetus for a public conversation, and that is one that Aloud and the Library Foundation is very, very honored to host tonight. Anita Hill minds her own family's extraordinary experience of finding home. For me, she writes, home is inextricably linked to the story of how my family, in one generation, and we have many of Anita Hill's family here in the audience, we welcome them, went from being property to owning property. Her grandparents left Arkansas for Oklahoma in the wake of a lynching, and their exile, writes Hill, resulted in a family diaspora that was, in its own way, as profound as my distant ancestors' wrenching displacement from the shores of Africa. Her mother, Irma Hill, would have been 100 this year, and though she could never have imagined the independence that the civil rights and women's rights movements offered women born in the 50s and 60s, she instilled in Anita, the youngest of her 13 children, a search for equality which she continues to this day and through this book and to this evening. Anita Hill is a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University, where she teaches courses on race and the law and gender equality. She is the author of Speaking Truth to Power, in which she wrote about her experiences as a witness in the Clarence Thomas hearings. Novelist Tyeri Jones writes of Hill's new book, and I agree with her so much, Hill connects the dots between the homemaking efforts of African Americans just after Reconstruction and the heartbreaking and enraging consequences of the subprime mortgage scandal. After reading this book, you will never see a house as just four walls and a roof. It is a dream, and we as Americans are the dreamers. We are also very honored tonight to have in conversation with Anita Hill, Pat Morrison, who I'm sure you are all quite familiar with. Pat is a writer and columnist for the Los Angeles Times and host of the daily Pat Morrison Public Affairs program on KPCC. She has won 6 Emmys and 6 Golden Mike Awards. And just the other night, she was honored on the stage by the Community Advocates with the Bill Stout Award. And I was thinking about that, and on my walk this morning, it occurred to me that we should strike a special coin that says, "In Pat Morrison, we trust." So please welcome Anita Hill and Pat Morrison. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louise. I'm wondering about the denomination of that coin, but we'll talk. You are all lovers of the library, as am I. I was here a week ago, up here, being interviewed rather than doing the interviewing. And for me, the library is the second home. And I'm not being metaphorical because, ladies, that was my toothbrush in the bathroom that you saw there. But I'm so happy to be here tonight with a woman who has made a difference in so many lives, in my life, in giving me courage and heart at a time, I think, when she needed courage and heart. I hope she felt what so many of us were sending her way. We'll be talking about two moments in history, one 20 years ago and one now, both of them seminal in a lot of ways to the public dialogue as well as the private lives of many, many Americans. 20 years ago, of course, the Clarence Thomas hearings, and now when we find so many Americans at risk of their homes and their livelihood and questioning exactly what it is to be an American, what's expected of us and what we expect of others in this country. And we will, as you heard Louise say, be taking questions a little bit later. As always, I have a hat pin, so the eight-word limit, you know, we're going to be there.
Does that apply to me, too?
No. You get all the words that you would like. And she'll also be reading bits and passages from the book so you can get a flavor of the language with which this book was undertaken. So thank you all for being here, and thank you for coming and talking to us, too. This is not the first time she's had... Anita Hill has had unbelievable ovations. I remember seeing somewhere women were standing on chairs and cheering you as you traveled and talked around the country. But let's talk about those 20 years and start with the current 20-year moment, the 2008 to the present we find ourselves in. The issue of home for African Americans has always been very different because if you go back 150, 200 years, home was someone else's home that you had no right to be in. You could be disposed with as a piece of furniture. And so how is it a different concept for African Americans, as you outline it in the book, for your family as well?
Well, absolutely. And speaking of my family, I know Louise mentioned that I do have family members. But I do want to start with my family because that's where I start in the book. And the whole idea of what home means in many ways, it's you can think of it as sort of as a place. And I think of it more than a place. I think of it as a state of being at home in this country. And in order to establish our being at home in America, for me, for my family, my great-grandparents and grandparents, it began with finding that place. For my grandparents, it was homesteaded 80 acres of land in Little River County, Arkansas, that was the place where they just felt if they could have that home, if they could have that farm, then they could begin the economic development for their families, but they could also begin to secure political rights and social rights for their family. And so home really became that symbol or that emblem of belonging in this country. And it got expressed through many of us, through many African Americans, in fact, through farming. But then it sort of moved into urban areas after the Great Migration to cities in the north. But for my family, it's really been rural life until my generation, which my siblings are here, and they can attest to the fact that we had that rural life that really defined who we were, as well as our place in the community and how the world looked at us. But you know, it's the thing that I think I try to bring to this book is that even though the experience has a racial meaning and there's a context that is racial, we all know that in fact there is a gender aspect of home and belonging. And so the feeling of home and the importance of home not only changes from race and ethnic experience, but it also changes, it's different for men and women. And so that's what I try to bring together as I discuss throughout the book.
You also talk about the current economic crisis and the new kind of homelessness that it has created. In the 1930s, early in the 30s, you have President Hoover who is talking about home ownership as the great American standard, the push toward everybody getting a home. And in fact, home ownership is a stabilizing political influence because if people have an actual physical stake, they participate more, they take more interest in public affairs. But then from President Hoover, who made so many people homeless, curiously, we moved to this era where, as you point out, blacks and Latinos and women in particular have been blamed for taking out loans, for buying houses, for buying into the American dream, and getting victimized by mortgage scams, and yet being told by the public at large, well, you should have known you couldn't have undertaken this without putting yourself at risk. You were the one who took a chance that you shouldn't have taken. There's a paradox in that that you go into in some depth here.
Well, it's almost as though it's a game of gotcha. You know, you get people to believe in the American dream and to really pursue it vigorously. And then when you have something like urging people to get into the dream, then you have banks that are willing to take advantage of the years of racism, years of discrimination that have been embedded into lending practices and that are clearly present or were clearly present, particularly in the years between 2003 and 2008, in the years leading up to the collapse of the housing market. And so all of those years of sexism where women couldn't get credit at all to buy homes in their own names, all those years of redlining and predatory practices really sort of came back. We enticed people to buy into the American dream, and then we gave them these really toxic options for getting there. And then, as it turns out, we blame them because they actually succumbed to many of these come-ons and took out these loans that ultimately were bundled and sold and up the, the financial market food chain and led to the global collapse of the financial system.
And they're being blamed for it.
And they're being blamed for it. But what I try to talk about in the book is really how, in fact, what they're being blamed for was really rooted in years, if you will, centuries really, of discrimination. That what happened, and much of the work that I do is based on a series of lawsuits, series of sworn statements from banking officials, where bankers say that, in fact, we knew that when a person called for a loan, we would try to make sure that if they were a minority or if they were a woman or if they were an elderly person, that we tacked on as many fees as we could onto their loans so that they got high-cost loans. And so we brought them into this system that we knew was going to explode, that the prices were going to escalate, and they were going to be well beyond what people could pay. And
here's,
targeted them.
Here's the Illinois Attorney General. Let me read this. She said, as a result of discriminatory, and this is her characterizing this bank's practices, as a result of its discriminatory and illegal mortgage lending practices, Wells Fargo transformed our city's predominantly African-American and Latino neighborhoods into ground zero for subprime lending, as if it were a target in a battle.
It was really as though those communities were the testing ground. And so many of those communities, especially in the African-American communities, were headed by, homes were headed by single women. And so they were single women, in, not only in the African-American community, but single women throughout the country became the new entrants into the market. Whereas at one point they had been one in every 15 buyers on their own buying real estate, they became one in every five. And so they were also targeted. And so the testing ground started in Latino communities and African-American communities and then extended to single women, women buying on their own. And then it went, you know, sort of mushroomed and it went to everyone. So much so, though, and people say, well, why would a bank do that? Why do banks do that? Because the bankers were getting wealthy. In the year of 2005, and This is one of the situations that I talk about. In 2005, when subprime lending was at its height, the CEO of Wells Fargo made $53 million, $53.1 million. And the following year...
I know she said made and not earned.
Well, he made it. His compensation was. And it put him in the number 12 spot on the Forbes list of all executives and number one among his banking peers. And Wells Fargo is the subject of the Attorney General suit. So somebody, these communities and individuals who were losing properties, these neighborhoods that were stripped of equity, social and economic equity, were losing all of this money and all of this wealth, and it was going somewhere. And in fact, you can trace it, actually, the years when those communities were being hit the hardest, individuals like the CEO of Wells Fargo were getting very wealthy. One year alone, he made, I believe it was $7 million in bonuses. It's not as though the money was just lost. It went somewhere. It ultimately did go somewhere.
You have a subtext to the concept of home, and that's the concept of family, and how different its iterations are when, for more than 200 years, black people in this country couldn't count on having a family, on could not be legally wed, could not count on their families being there. And you go back to Daniel Patrick Moynihan and his report on the black family, and while we are at this point redefining family thanks to biological breakthroughs and innovations, thanks to same-sex marriage, the black family was already in flux, and to use a different model to use that standard cookie-cutter model also did not serve the black community in the long run, or the women in it in particular.
Well, in particular, Daniel Moynihan was quite harsh when it came to his expectation of black women. And people remember the Moynihan report, and it was supposed to be a recipe for improving African Americans' lives and getting them more toward economic sufficiency. And of course, it was a major issue in the early 1960s that the government was willing to take on. Nevertheless, his formula for improving the lives of a community required black women to stay at home, to not be independent, to not want to go out and get an education and to go out and work on their own. And it was, in fact, this recipe that he had for the community was a recipe for disaster, because we know that especially now, black women's labor was critical to the economic advancement of African-American families. And with the changes in families and with the problems with the high cost of medical care, with the high cost of education, with the high cost of real estate now, most families rely on income of two people. And so, that formula, that idea that the family was somehow going to be this idealized nuclear family with a one parent staying at home, just really wasn't even well suited for that time, but it certainly doesn't follow now.
There, you take as one case study in your book a woman named Marla from Los Angeles. And those of you who are familiar with LA and California history will know that California had, like many places, restrictive covenants in real estate. You could not sell to, as the book says, quote, Negroes and Mongolians. This was in the real estate contract. And many people owned houses without realizing this was rare. Ronald Reagan's house up on Cordell in the Hollywood Hills had a restrictive covenant in it. This was written into the law so long ago that it became a matter of fact. But then in the 1960s, you had people like Hattie McDaniel who were breaking those restrictive covenants, trying to buy into neighborhoods. Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun, which you talk about, goes to that. But in California, the Rumsford Fair Housing Act in 1964 banned that. Well, California voters didn't like being told who they could and could not sell to, so they went to the polls and they voted by 3/4 to permit themselves to discriminate in housing. Now, we were talking about the Constitution. We were just chatting about the Constitution, Anita Hill and I. Yeah. Don't I love that part?
And we do it all the time.
And so, you know, our Constitution is a minoritarian Constitution. It looks after the minorities. So what happens? The California Initiative goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, no way are we going to allow you to discriminate like that. 99% of Californians could have voted for it, and it still didn't make it right. So let's go to the case of Marla and how this additional obstacle of restrictive covenants inhibited home ownership for African Americans and minorities, and what ended up happening, how that got built into the system.
Well, first of all, let's take into account the fact that for years these restrictions existed. And what happened was that the restrictions then followed, after the restrictions followed banking practices. So with the restrictions, you also had redlining, which meant that certain neighborhoods were not given funding for, certain people were not funded for to buy homes in certain neighborhoods. So what the long and short of it is that certain neighborhoods were just created, and they were racially created. And so, and those continue to exist. Those racial restrictions, the vestiges of those exist in cities throughout the country, in Los Angeles, of course. We know they exist. It's not by chance that neighborhoods become racially isolated. They become racially isolated because of a whole history of racism. And they become racially isolated in part because of neglect and a lack of feeling of community, so that what happens in a racially restricted neighborhood is felt by people who don't live in them. So we isolate the neighborhoods, and in some ways we assume that, okay, well, if we isolate them, then we don't have to pay attention to the problems. We can all live in our other neighborhoods that we enjoy, and the violence or the lack of services or the lack of facilities that are occurring in those neighborhoods are not a problem. And so in Marla's case, that all of those elements came together to really contribute to her trying to shape a home for herself and her children in a neighborhood that was becoming increasingly susceptible to the violence around it, ultimately resulting in the death of her son. And I talk about her story and all of the elements that came together. And as I talk about the story, Marla's story, and it is a tragic story in many ways, but it's also a story of hope. The hope that she has for facing the future, even in the face of this tragedy, for coming together with her neighbors, understanding and believing and once again and being able to reach out to the facilities, to networks, and to the people in the community and resources that are available, even though they seem somewhat inadequate to many of the people who she's found who are in her position as well.
I'm sure you've heard the argument that once redlining ended, when black communities were not exclusively black communities and black professionals moved out into different neighborhoods, that damaged the people who were left behind, because you didn't see the doctor, you didn't see the school teacher. And I want to talk about your own school teacher here, Ms. Young, who gave you your luggage that was so well traveled. But
well, let me talk a little bit about that.
That argument.
One of the things that I hear, we did have a very idealized idea about advancement for African Americans. And if you have any doubt about how strongly it is linked to where we find our homes, I talk about A Raisin in the Sun, and those of you know the play of the younger family, mother living with two of her adult children and a daughter-in-law all in the home and a grandchild. The mother comes across inherits some money, and it's actually from a life insurance policy her husband left her. And she takes the money, or wants to take the money, to buy a home in a neighborhood that's racially restricted. And for me, when I was growing up, that play really was a symbol of what it meant if we could just get into a place. If we could break down those barriers, that was really an idea for me, gave me my first idea of what is the end game for equality. The end game is being able to buy a home wherever we can afford to buy a home. And that was kind of in the 1960s, I think it was an idea that we really adopted, that we would no longer be defined by a place. Now, for many of us, though, raisin in the sun doesn't quite say it in the same way that a 1970s and 80s sitcom does. And sitcoms are popular cultures. For those of you who aren't into literature, popular culture works, and there are powerful messages sent through popular culture, and I talk about those. How many of you remember the sitcom The Jeffersons? Okay. So when George and Louise Jefferson make it in the country, you know, they are successful, what do? They move on up, right? To the seaside. And I mean, and it's so idealized, it is the deluxe apartment in the sky.
You guys are good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the symptoms are good. Now, think about that. What it meant to succeed was for all of us to move to opulence, really, because if you know the Upper East Side, that's pretty opulent. But then there's that other part of it, as I say, the gender part of it, that we often don't talk about. And what happened when Louise Jefferson, remember when she was on All in the Family, she came in and she worked and had her uniform on and she worked in the store. Well, she became a stay-at-home homemaker when they moved up to the deluxe apartment, and she didn't have to fry fish or burn beans on the grill. But she also did another thing. She got a maid. And she not only got a maid, she got a black maid. And so our ideas about what the role of the home in establishing us as having made it gets shaped really in sitcoms. It gets shaped in plays like A Raisin in the Sun. And I talk about how that plays into the American way of thinking about home. And the way that we think about African Americans and women, when women have made it, we stay at home. We don't go out and work. We stay at home, and we get somebody else.
You don't know how, or you don't have to work.
You don't have to work. Not that any of us would want to work, but we don't have to work. And so that is how we have defined making it. And what I ultimately say is that that is a skewed way of thinking. That instead of thinking about equality as opulence, as our way of buying our way into equality, we ought to be thinking about equality as community and a community of equals. And so that's why I came up with the idea of reimagining equality. How can we reimagine it so that we're not pricing a whole, as I say now, I guess 99% of us, out of it? How can we imagine it as those of us coming together in a community and working together so that regardless of where one calls home, you still have access to all of the opportunities that this country has to offer?
Which brings us to the most famous home in America, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and you talk about that.
The election of Barack Obama to me was something that was, I know people say, well, is it just symbolism? It's more than symbolic. For the first time, to have an African American in the nation's most famous home was, to me, one of those moments, of course, everyone says we never thought it would happen. But it was important in a number of ways. In particular, it was not, I had grown up in an era where we had the right to vote. Women have the right to vote. People of color have the right to vote. And so we have the right to say who represents us. But to have Barack Obama now says that African Americans have the right to represent all of us. And that was significant. That's a significant moment in our history. It's a change in our history that I don't think we should take lightly. But we have to really give meaning to that. We can't simply say, okay, well, now we've made that hurdle and that's all we need to do. We've got to make sure, one, that everyone really, you know, we can say, oh, that election means that everybody has the right to and an opportunity to be whatever they want to in this country. Well, you can't say that when, in fact, we know that where one lives determines their access to, determines what the quality of education their children are going to receive. It determines their access to jobs, to work. In many cases, it determines whether or not they're going to be able to walk out of their door and on the streets at night. And it even determines basic things like where you're going to be able to buy groceries, whether or not you're going to be able to walk down the street and get nutritious food. All of those things really, to me, came together to help me think about how significant home is in the determination of equality. And so that's what prompted me, along with the election of Barack Obama and his position in the White House as the resident of the White House.
We were talking about the opportunity to choose where to live, the Lorraine Hansberry play and the end of redlining. But your family experienced having not have that opportunity, being forced to move because of, in a sense, violent redlining that they encountered in Arkansas.
Well, the violence that my grandparents experienced after really getting to that point where they had homesteaded 80 acres of land, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do the research, and I had heard these family stories about my grandparents having this farm in Arkansas that they had left, and there were all these stories about why they left. And I first had to say, how did my grandfather, Henry Elliott, who was born a slave, get to moving from being property to owning property? And I found the documents where in 1895 he had homesteaded the property, 80 acres, in Little River County. He took possession in December 1895, and in January 1896 moved into the property in a two-room cabin. Henry Elliott, Ida Crooks Elliott, my grandmother, and seven of their children in this two-room cabin. And every year they would cultivate by hand acres, 4 or 5 acres a year, until after 5 years they had cultivated 20 acres, all by hand. And then, and I will say this, I did get the deeds from the Bureau of Land Management. And again, this whole gender issue popped up again because his name, William Henry Elliott, right there on the document. My grandmother's name is nowhere on it. In fact, the reference to my grandmother is in a question, does the applicant have a family? And it said, yes, a wife and seven children. So that's the reference. That was her ability, even with all the work that she had to do to make this farm a reality. She was not recognized legally as an owner of this property.
And certainly couldn't vote to change that.
And she couldn't do anything about it. And so, again, there's this gender element that goes through, but my grandparents left Arkansas, brought their family to Oklahoma, because my grandfather was threatened to be lynched. And there are two different versions of it. One was that my Uncle George told me, my mother's brother said, that in fact that a white farmer had asked my grandfather if my grandmother would do some housework for him. And my grandfather said, Henry Elliott said, no, she's busy, because by that time I think they had maybe 12 children themselves. She's pretty busy. and she no doubt was doing her own work. And the farmer said, we'll be back to see you tonight. And of course, if you know the South in that era, you know that these were threats and that they were meaningful threats. And so ultimately, they never came back on that visit, but ultimately the pressure was such that they did leave rural Oklahoma, rural Arkansas, and moved the family to Oklahoma. And my uncle tells the story. He said that he was excited because he was going to be on a train for the first time.
He was seven.
My mother was 4 or 5, and he was 7 years old, and he was excited to be on the train for the first time in his life. And ironically, for those of you who are legal historians, we all know that the train that they got on to go to Oklahoma was a segregated train because of Plessy versus Ferguson, and legalized segregation. But he also said it was the first time that he'd ever seen his father cry. And the father was moving because he wanted a better life for his children than the threats that they were receiving in Arkansas. But to give up so much really meant that they were starting again. But they were starting at a place where they hoped that America would live up to its promises.
Is there a passage that you'd like to read that kind of illuminates what we've been talking about?
Well, I want to read a passage, and as I mentioned, these were my maternal grandparents. I may not have mentioned that, but it was the move to Oklahoma that ultimately allowed my parents, Albert and Irma Hill, to establish their family. And really, I believe, live out some of the dreams that her father and mother had for her and her siblings. And ultimately, the farm life was not for us because the country was changing. You couldn't sustain yourself economically on the farm. And so I talk a lot about my mother's choices. And my mother was one of the few of her siblings who stayed on the farm. And she stayed there, and she raised her with my father. They raised 13 children. And we often think about equality in terms of movement, that we move toward equality. In fact, Ira Berlin, in his book, The Making of African America, talks about this long slavery to freedom narrative that was developed by his colleague, John Hope Franklin, who you've seen here. It is a story, he said, the story of African America is a story of movement. It is a story of moving from one location to the next in search of equality, in search of freedom. But in all of that movement, there is always someone who stays. And my mother was the woman who stayed, who got to Oklahoma and stayed on the farm and tried to live out equality through staying. And I asked the question in the book, what would equality look like if we imagine it from the perspective of those who seek it not by moving, but by staying and building? My mother's greatest gift to me was the freedom to leave. And that I did at the age of 21 when I went off to law school with my two sets of luggage, which I'll talk about later. But that was her greatest gift to me, to leave a life that she had lived and to go out into a world that she really didn't know anything about. And I had always been enamored of the story of movement and thinking that movement meant progress, and that was the best way to measure progress. But over time, I have come to realize that the most enduring lessons Irma Hill passed on to me were about how, once planted, to stay and to make a home. And so what I propose now, when I think about how do we make sure that we secure home for everyone, how do we make sure that people don't have to move from foreclosed properties or move from communities that have been affected by the foreclosure crisis that are no longer safe? How do we secure equality for people who stay rather than requiring them to move to some other setting to seek equality? And that, I think, is the challenge of the 21st century, that we can't continue to say to people, well, you just have to move to a better neighborhood, or you have to move to a more expensive house that we can't afford. We've got to, you know, to show that you've made it in this country, you've got to take out a huge mortgage and pay over 50% of your income to be able to put a roof over your head. How do we create a society that is about sustaining people where they are and making sure that all of our communities are safe and secure? And that, I think, is the challenge of the 21st century, and that's the vision for equality in the 21st century that I ask people to pursue.
One of the ways you do that is by giving people voices. And I want to go back 19 years to 1992, was the year of the woman in politics. For the first time in the history of this country, a state had two United States senators who were women. That was California. Maine would soon follow suit. And 1992 was possible because of what happened in 1991 with this woman, when many people were given strength and voice because of what it was that she went through. She sat in front of a United States Senate committee that had no minority faces. It had no female faces. And not only what was said, but what was seen really changed the perception of the country. It made it possible to talk about sexual harassment in a legitimate way that women had never felt able to before. And it became so much part of the discussion that it's an everyday part of workplace rules, how you conduct yourself and how you do not. So I'd like to hear from the perspective now of 20 years. In the heat of the moment, you couldn't have imagined, I don't think, how much what happened with you changed what happens every day with the rest of us.
Oh, well, absolutely. When I testified in 1991, for me, what was at stake was the integrity of the court. That was what my testimony was about. That's what I was there to talk about, the qualifications of an individual who was going to be appointed to a lifetime position on the highest court in the country, who was going to be defining rights for all of us, for who knows how many years. He was in his 40s, I believe, at the time. So for conceivably for decades. And the integrity of the court was what was at stake. An unintended consequence, really one that was clearly not foreseen at least, was the opening up of the conversation on sexual harassment. And we can talk about how that conversation took place. But I think the most powerful way that it took place was within our home, where women talked to their daughters and told their stories of working in workplaces where they were abused and extorted, where women talked to, sometimes for the first time, told stories to their spouses, where women really found a language for addressing something that had been happening to us really since we began working. And so that was the power, that sort of was the way we began the conversation. Ultimately, what got affected was law, legislation, was passed in 1991 following the hearing, because the public demanded it. Not because the leadership wanted it. In fact, the law that was passed, George Bush had threatened to veto this particular 1991 civil rights law if it got through Congress. Of course, he didn't do it. But he didn't do it, not because he was in favor of it. He didn't do it because the public finally said sexual harassment is wrong. And it wasn't the majority of the public. It didn't have to be. It just had to be a vocal minority. And that was all of you who really believe in gender equality and know that it cannot happen in an atmosphere where sexual harassment is allowed to run rampant. You know, we used to believe that, in fact, women just, if you could just get women in the door, that would be how we could realize equality. But then we began to realize in 1991 that was not enough, that we had to change the culture of our workplace. And so that began to happen, where workplace rules were passed, where behavior was confronted, and where much of harassment, especially the blatant harassment, came to an end. Not all of it, and not enough of it, because it still continues. So, but it was that public conversation, the private conversation that went public, let's say, that ultimately got us to move beyond where we were in 1991, in situations that were so full of myths and misogyny about women's experiences, and that women were trapped often in these workplace situations with no recourse. That has changed. And it changed because of the public, because people said no more. And that's what I believe can happen, really, when we start looking at issues of inequality today. That's why, you know, I talk about having a home summit where we can address many of the issues that led us into this foreclosure system situation, got us into this mess, and ways to get us out of it.
As much as it benefited so many of us, and I remember women older than I who were talking about having PTSD kind of experiences, as they were hearing you talk, they thought, oh, I remember that. They'd suppressed it so much. But this came at a great personal cost. Mm-hmm. Clarence Thomas said it came at a personal cost to him. You were vilified. You were only writing in here about opening your mail, getting a filing system going. What was the public response? What did you hear and see, and how did people treat you thereafter?
Well, it was a mixed bag, especially initially. I tell people now that I have roughly 25,000 letters and cards and messages. And just to date how long 20 years ago was, I have telegrams.
That's email on yellow paper.
That's right. Telegrams and faxes. And it was difficult because not all of those 25,000, as you can imagine, were supportive. Some of them were threatening. There were all kinds of things going on. There were bomb threats that I had to endure. But enough of them were supportive that I knew that something important was happening, that we were finally waking up to some of the issues that we needed to confront in order to have equality. But I tell people that I was very fortunate. And I keep coming back to this, and you'll forgive me, indulge me a little bit one more time, but I had a wonderful family. I had a wonderful family. Not everybody has that. And I can tell you that I have talked to women who have had to come forward and not be supported by members of their own household. And I can tell you that I had women who wrote me who said, if my husband ever found out I wrote this letter, he'll kill me. So don't send me anything back. And I had a wonderful family, two wonderful parents, siblings who never doubted me. And that really can get you through a lot. But I also had a lot of good colleagues and friends, people who came forward, who testified, who were friends, and we're still friends today. So, you know, they're real friends who will go through that with you. And then I had the support of so many people who were strangers. And all of those things came together to get me through that event and that episode that went on and on for years, honestly, in my time in Oklahoma.
And even the recent phone message in your
office
from Mrs. Thomas.
Yes, but you know, 19 years does a lot for you.
How's that delete button working?
Oh, no, I saved that message.
Okay.
But what it also reminded me of when I got it and then the news story broke, I started getting more messages. You know, and so what it says was, you know, this issue really resonates. And so I talked to friends and I said, look, this hearing had meaning to people in their lives. They still feel passionate about it. People say, I remember where I was when you testified. And so this was a year ago. Let's take it. Let's reclaim it. Let's not let Jenny Thomas have the last word, or let this become some punchline in a joke on, I think it was at the newsmakers' dinner they have at the...
Oh, the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
White House Correspondents' Dinner. You can see how I'm plugged into politics here. The White House Correspondents. Let's not leave this where it is. Let's figure out what it means and how we can move forward with that energy. And so... fast forward a year later, a number of people organized around the hearing. There was an event at Georgetown Law Center, one at Hunter College. Women in South Columbia, South Carolina, had their 20th anniversary Anita Hill party. They've been doing this for 20 years. And you've never seen it.
Did they all come as you? Was this like some...
Well, they come
inner
as
Anita
very
Hill?
Empowered women. And I'll take that. And so, yes, it's, you know, we have to claim this. We have to decide what it means. We can't let other people decide what it means. And that is really, to me, that is the legacy. Then women have been empowered, that they have found their voices. They developed advocacy, not only for themselves, but for young women. And that's what came out of these events that have happened in the last few weeks.
You're a lawyer and a legal historian, so it's a little odd to think of yourself as having one of those places, one of those benchmarks in history.
Well, it is odd to be me, yes.
Now that's probably the quote of the night.
it's odd in many ways, especially, and I always say that I think people expect when they, you know, I walked out here that I was going to be wearing that same turquoise suit.
Did you keep it?
Oh yes, I have that suit. I am so fortunate that I have been able to go on to have my career, to grow in my career, but also to make that event meaningful in my own life. It's not something that I wish for, but having had it occur, now it was really kind of up to me to figure out what to do with it. And that's really about taking authority of your own life and not letting it be controlled by those people who really don't have your best interest in mind.
Well, I'm going to take control and let you have questions. If you want to raise your hands if you have a question, we'll try to bring the microphone around to you. If you could stand up, and I'm counting the 8 words. I'll count down here. So.
And she has a hat pin.
I do have that hat pin. All right. Could you stand up, please?
Sure. Oh, my goodness. I know. Okay. Have you ever seen Clarence Thomas since the hearings? And if not, if you were to see him again, what would you say to him? Would you go out and have a couple of drinks, soda, I don't know.
Boy, this must be California. I have no intention of going out and having a couple of drinks with California, with Clarence Thomas. I just don't see any reason for it. I have no desire for it. And that's not going to happen. So, no.
Another question? Where do you have? Oh, here we have one.
Ms. Hill, how and why were you selected to testify before the committee, and why not any of the other women who had similar stories?
I think you were drafted.
I was subpoenaed. I was approached by the Senate Judiciary Committee a couple of times about my experience. Apparently, there were rumors out there, and there were people who knew that I had worked for Clarence Thomas, and those were rumors that existed. I had, by that time, moved to Oklahoma, was living in Oklahoma, and the committee in investigating his character came to me and asked me to confirm, and after a number of conversations where I was trying to assure myself that this was not some fishing expedition, I gave them a sworn statement. There were other women who were ready to testify. One woman even came out of her hospital bed to testify. We waited and waited, and they were never called. I think not only was it a disservice to the public, but it was a disservice to those women and their experiences. And the full story, one can only speculate about what would have happened had they been allowed. But they were there, and there probably are records, if you read some of the books, Abramson and Meyer book, that will tell you about them and what they had to say.
Do you think if the same circumstances today, knowing what we know and how much more seriously sexual harassment is taken, that he would have been confirmed? It was the closest vote in recent history.
Well, I don't think we would have gotten to the point that we did. I think that would have been taken seriously enough from the beginning. Remember, the Senate Judiciary Committee wasn't even going to have a hearing on it until the public, and a minority came and said, you've got to take this seriously. Women, in particular women from the House of Representatives, went over. Your now Senator Barbara Boxer, one of them, and tried to say to the Senate, the women of this country deserve better, and you've got to take this seriously. And it was that kind of pressure that then ultimately led to them having a hearing. I don't think they would have to be pressured today. And I think it might have been dealt with even behind the scenes today.
Over here?
I'm not sure. I guess I just want to ask you, is there any way 20 years later to make any sense out of the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case?
Well, I think I hear in your voice a sense that of the frustration that a lot of people felt. That, gosh, we really haven't gotten anywhere. But I think most of us were disappointed in the outcome, that there was not even a trial. Or many of us, maybe some people weren't disappointed. But let's think about it this way. The fact that the Sofitel Hotel reacted to the charge against this very powerful man is a change. The fact that the police were willing to go to the airport and pull someone off a first-class ticket to Europe is a change. The fact that the colleagues of made the all of the housekeepers in these hotels were able to line up and show their support for her is a change, because they felt empowered to do that. Now that's a change. And then that the police urged the district attorney to continue to pursue the charge. Ms. Diallo's charges, that's all change. Ultimately, what we have to, and this is sort of the lawyer now coming in, we have to understand that the state acting through the district attorney makes different decisions than even the public makes. And whereas the public was outraged, and if we had it all to do, we'd probably gone through the trial, had the prosecution, state often makes decisions that don't reflect the public's desire. And I'm not a criminal lawyer, and I certainly don't represent the state in terms of how they made those decisions. But I do think that there is something that we can take heart in, even in that episode, even though the outcome does not suit us, our sense of fairness and our sense of justice. One of the things that I am doing is I'm working with a colleague of mine, Bernadette Bruden, in the spring, and we're putting together a conference where we're bringing together prosecutors, we're bringing together scholars to talk about the difficulty of prosecuting rape and sexual assault cases, and in particular, cases involving issues of race. And so we are, again, trying to move us forward. And I believe if the public keeps moving forward, our law enforcement will as well. But we've got to push it. We still have to push it. And we keep saying, well, how can we, you know, we've got to make sure that women can come forward safely and that when they do come forward, that their rights are going to be recognized.
We have another question from over here. Oh, right here.
Ms. Hill, you mentioned the family of being very important, and also that two breadwinners are important for survival, economic survival. Why is it in the African-American population you have such disintegration of the family structure by having so many single parents raising children? I'm talking about usually mothers. Where is the responsibility for the males or the and so on? And we've had million man marches, we've had everything. How do you change that cycle? If not, you're doomed to continue.
Well, I think one of the problems or one of the mistakes we make and that Moynihan made was to blame the women for those situations. And in some ways, I think some of that is still happening. But what we have to realize is that what was happening in the African-American community with more families being headed by single women is happening in all communities now. So we can say, well, you know, it's an African-American problem, or we can say this is a social problem. And it's a social problem in many ways. Because of the lack of economic opportunities for African Americans, if you think a problem is acute for African Americans, I think a way to solve it is to make sure there are more economic opportunities available for both African American men and women, and that I think will reduce the number somewhat. But really what we're talking about is a social and cultural change that is happening throughout communities. And so why, if it's happening throughout communities, then we have to realize that we need more affordable housing, safe and affordable housing for everyone. So that we know that the family is changing, that more are being headed by one breadwinner in the household. So to price people really out of safe housing really is what's dooming them and not the structure of the family. To not attend to the fact that women on their own are still only making 80 cents on the dollar that men are making, to not attend to that fact, that really is what is continuing to put those families at a disadvantage. And so all of these things have to be taken into account. If we know, in fact, that that is the trend that we're headed toward, we need to start saying, well, maybe we're not going to have that idealized family that we thought we were going to have, that, you know, the June Cleaver and stay-at-home mom. So now, how do we deal with the reality of the society that we have now? And what can we do about it to make sure that every home is supported?
Over here.
What's your take on today's confirmation process?
I think it's probably not, we don't get as much information as we would like, but I think in today's political climate, we're just not going to be able to have the kind of give and take and real full disclosure about people and what their ideology is, what their ideas about judging are, what their philosophies about judging are, because things have been very politicized. And so I think the confirmation process today really is a reflection of the politics of the day, far too much.
And even the protection 20 years ago, Clarence Thomas saying, no, he never really talked about Roe versus Wade, which at the time seemed really implausible. Somebody up there got that.
Yeah.
And so the fact is, like, protecting the quarterback, the less you are forthcoming about, the greater your odds of getting mm-hmm. confirmed, but then you don't know what you're getting on the court.
You don't know, and moreover, I think that, you know, now you have a public that wants to know about what the court is doing and what the law means and what we can expect in terms of protecting rights and interests in this country. I mean, we want a court that, you know, quite frankly, we want to know if the court is going to protect corporations as humans or individuals or whatever they're called. We want to know that. We're not getting that now. Now, the public is not informed about what the court is doing, and I think that's a disservice to a public that has the right to know where people stand. And it's, to me, it doesn't even matter. We say, well, Republicans are doing it, Democratic nominees are doing it. We're all doing it. It's a game now that we play, and the public loses.
This will be our last question.
What is your suggestion for creating taxpayer advocacy for pressuring the banks to bail out the public, since the government bailed out the banks?
Instead of the other way around.
Where's the law in prosecuting that wrongdoing? What do you think?
Well, as I say, in Reimagining Equality, look, individuals got wealthy. In many communities, what was happening was tantamount to fraud. It was predatory. And you're right. Nobody has gone to jail. Nobody really has been prosecuted in criminal court for it. Now, the state attorneys general in Delaware and New York are now investigating it. We don't know if the Justice Department has done any investigation or is going to do. But we want our government agencies to work. The laws have changed tremendously since the last banking scandal, where people did go to jail. The laws have been changed. But I don't see any rigorous enforcement of the, you know, I don't know what the existing laws are so lax that they can't be prosecuted. But we want our Justice Department and our Attorney General to find out, do those investigations. That's one level of protection. But I do think that, you know, these are some of the issues I think that Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Los Angeles and Occupy Boston are bringing to our attention. The fact that banks did get rich, bankers got rich, they were then bailed out for whatever losses they suffered, and now they're getting richer and people are losing their homes. Millions of people are experiencing this kind of home insecurity now. It started with communities of color and extended to single women. But now it's all of us. It's all of us. We all have an interest in this. And the pressure really can't simply be to get the banks to bail out people. Because what I'm afraid of is that if we do that, if that's all we do, what's going to happen is that we're going to be back to where we were in 2003. And we're going to have communities and individuals that are vulnerable to new devices and new practices. So we've got to institute consumer protections. We've got to, more importantly, change those conditions that exist that make people vulnerable in the communities. We've got to do something about the fact that, you know, certain communities get isolated from public services. And we know it exists. The choices that we make, that government makes, have to be different, or we're doomed to repeat this again. And then finally, I would just say, think about it this way. There are so many people now who are suffering from this foreclosure crisis and this collapse. Think about how that is going to be visited on their children. Are they going to be able to afford an education, the price of which is going up? And how are we attending to the issues that are confronting the next generation? You describe this book as a call for action. I think it's a call for action. I am so happy that these economic issues are being brought to mind by Occupy Wall Street. But we know that most of us are not going to go out and camp out on the grounds at Wall Street or any place else. Most of us are not going to do that. So what can we do? Taxpayer groups can do something to put pressure on the government so that they can pressure the bank. But really, we have to come together as a collective and to review all of this whole host of policies that are putting us in jeopardy of repeating what has happened in the last few years. And so what I try to do really is a call for action and really ideas about all of the issues that we need to confront and address to keep that from happening again and keep from visiting the effects of this catastrophe on generations to come.
Well, thank you for occupying our library, and thanks to Anita Hill.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.